Hi, this is Paul, and this is Rough Draft for Sunday, where I walk through the current status of my Sunday sermon. They're not playing any video. Some of you know I've been having some sound issues on my channel and not playing any video clips, so there won't be any on here. I'm still trying to debug and figure out what exactly is going on. Where the Line Really Lies. This is an interesting video talking about mathematical challenges to Darwin's theory of evolution. And over the last 2 years, I've heard a lot of back and forth about God and evolution and all of these things. And so often it seems that where the line really lies is whether or not this world or our lives are a product of a designer, or merely the product of chaos or chance. The Simpsons, in a sort of funny way, illustrated this with a standard illustration of a million monkeys chained to typewriters. Will they produce? How much time will it take for them to produce the world's greatest novel? And so Mr. Burns reads, "It was the best of times, it was the blurst of times." And I loved how the little monkeys had little pipes and little cigarettes as they were shackled to the typewriters as they bang along endlessly. But it asks deeper questions of the world, like what does the story of this world mean anything? There's a very interesting movie called Life Itself, in which in many ways it illustrates the assumption of many people, and that one of the people in this movie comes to the realization that life itself is a completely unreliable narrator. This idea goes all the way back to Shakespeare and before, of course, in Macbeth. "The queen, my lord, is dead, he is told. She should have died hereafter. There would have been a time for such a word. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day, to the last syllable of recorded time, and all our yesterdays have lighted fools. The way to dusty death. Out, 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 brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage, and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing." Now, the ancients didn't believe that. To them, the world was alive. It was dangerous. It was chaotic. But it was alive. And Israel's God was not someone you toyed with, but was someone that you could talk to. But over time, especially after the Enlightenment and the Scientific Revolution, the world became math and nature. Rather than being a living thing, nature was a series of laws, a machine. It was locked down by the laws of cause and effect. Do not ask why it's all here. There is no why in math. There just is. And ultimately, in this universe, we are alone. We have agency, or we think we do. We have purpose, or we think we do. But ultimately, we are alone on this brief stage. Finally, a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. We suspect, fear that our agency, too, is merely math. Now, I want to change gears and ask you a question. Do you talk to your car? Do you have a name for it? Do you feel bashful about it? You go to the mechanic and your car needs to be fixed, and you joke around that you have a name, but it's just a car. It's just math. It's just gears and tubes and all kinds of things under that hood that you barely understand. Now, a while ago, a very smart man named Pascal thought up a bunch of math, also thought up a bunch of philosophy. He distinguished between two minds, and in many ways these two minds correspond to the two hemispheres of our mind. The right brain, which majors on unmapped territory, things that we don't know about, and likes to wonder about that. And the left brain focuses on mapped territory. He called the left brain the spirit of geometry, math. He called the right brain the intuitive mind, or the spirit of finesse. And you know what finesse is. Finesse is if you have a key that doesn't quite work right. And every time you get up to that lock, you think, maybe this time it won't start. Now my car, or maybe this time it won't open. One of my cars is named Ed, and Ed has a starting problem. And sometimes people try to start it and it doesn't start, and I say, it always starts on the second try, and it does. And it will, until it doesn't. So I approach Ed with a spirit of finesse. Now, it's natural, and you can hear math behind that, to engage that which is too complex for you to understand as a person, which is why you name your car. Now, what's interesting, though, is that you hate it when people treat you that way. We have a real distinction between things and people, and we use things and we love people, and we hate it when we are used, and we love it when people treat us with a spirit of finesse. They ask us a question. They don't know the response. We give them a response that leads to another question. Life opens up that way in a lovely dance of persons. But here the question is nature a person or is nature math? We approach other people with the spirit of finesse, step by step in time. Why am I talking all of this philosophy today? Well, there's a famous story we're going to read, and this is Rembrandt's depiction of it. One of the things Rembrandt did was imagine the stories of Jesus in his date and time. Now, many of us may read through this story with dismissive lenses. We think about Jesus and the laws of nature, and Jesus talks to a storm. How silly that must be. And if it happened at all, surely the storm must have quieted down just at the same time that it rose up, and it must be what we call a coincidence. And what we mean by coincidence are two things that happen together, but there's no causal link. On that day, now if you remember last week, this was the day that Jesus was teaching and preaching in parables to the crowd, and he was standing in a boat, and they were all there. Now remember, the boat is on the sea, and he's in a boat, and we've talked about that symbolic language, and we'll talk about it a little bit more today. On that day when evening came, that's darkness, that's also important, Jesus said to the disciples, let's go across to the other side. They're about to cross the sea in darkness, double chaos. But these are experienced fishermen. These people are used to being out in the sea in the darkness. That's probably why Jesus picked a good number of them. So after leaving the crowd, they took him along, just as he was, in the boat. Sit down, Jesus. We're heading for the other side. Must have been a pretty good-sized boat. And other boats were with him. Now a great wind. Now we're going to pay a little attention to that word, anemos. It's interesting because there are at least three words in Greek for wind. There's pneuma, which is used for breath or spirit. There's another one which used on the day of Pentecost, but this word is about the winds, and it's the four winds, and it's the winds of heaven, and it gets translated into the Old Testament often with this word. Now a great wind developed, and the waves were breaking onto the boat, so that the boat was nearly swamped, and Jesus, he, was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. Now remember, these are all experienced fishermen. They've known storms before. They woke him up and said to him, Teacher, don't you care that we are about to die? Now, that question is interesting. Doesn't he care? They didn't ask him to do something about it. They didn't try to wake him up for his own safety, that maybe in this great storm while he's unbelievably sleeping on a cushion. But don't you care? They want to know about his mind. They want to know about the spirit of finesse in Jesus. Does he love? Does he care? Is there purpose? Is he a person? So he got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the sea, Be calm, be quiet. Then the wind stopped, and it was dead calm. And he said to them, Why are you so cowardly? Do you still not have faith? Now at this point, you might wonder, these are strange questions. Of course they're scared. It's a great storm, and these are experienced fishermen on this particular sea with this particular boat. They'd have reason to believe it's scary when it's scary. They have an understanding of what is dangerous. Why does he call them cowards? Why does faith come into this at all? They were overwhelmed by fear. But now pay attention, it's dead calm. So what are they afraid of? Now, perhaps, they're thinking more clearly than they have the whole evening long. Because if you're afraid of a storm, you should be even more afraid of the one the storm listens to. Because if you can still a storm, you can conjure one. If you can raise the dead with a word, you can certainly make dead with a word. They were overwhelmed by fear and said to one another, "Who then is this sleeping in our boat?" Maybe they, like Jonah, should have thrown him out. Maybe they shouldn't have thought to waken him. Maybe now the fear of the storm is receding compared to the fear of him. Even the winds and the sea obey him. Now, real things scale. And as human beings, we can think these esoteric philosophical thoughts, but in many ways, they go all the way down to the bottom, whether we're fully conscious of them and can articulate them or not. Anyone in that boat would have had the same reaction. Notice that even an experience this powerful, however, won't lock the disciples into steadfast trust and obedience in Jesus. In the moment of the storm, they were terrified by the storm. In the aftermath of the storm, they were terrified by Jesus. But one moment leads to the next with our little brief consciousness window. And whatever is coming in at the moment tends to be what dominates our decisions and our realizations. We are, in fact, tossed by the wind and very susceptible to winds. Could this be what Jesus rebuked them for? Now, in the symbolic world of the Gospel of Mark, winds are God's servants. Sometimes in the Old Testament, winds are angels. Sometimes they blow chaff, leaving the wheat. They blow hard, and they choose between the living and the dead. God is enthroned upon them. The sea, as we've talked about before, is a source of chaos, danger, but also potential, death, and life. These fishermen, Jesus picks them because they are ones who go out into chaos in the boat. Now, in the ancient church, the church fathers very much saw this as sort of a continued parable, like the ones that we had read last week, where Jesus is in the boat, and the boat is the church, and the boat is always under threat by the storms of chaos around her. These fishermen should know better. Jesus chose them because they're the ones who pull life out of the chaos of the sea. Now the winds, however, are sort of like a dog welcoming home his master. Some of the church fathers had very interesting and colorful metaphors that they played with this story. And I like to think of it perhaps in terms of my little dog. When I come home, my little dog is all excited to see me, and he's simply a barrel of excitement just because I walk through the door. He's also very scary to guests, and if you come to my house and my dog doesn't know you, my dog will bite you. Is this what they faced with Jesus on the lake, welcoming the master home and terrifying the guests? But now, do you talk to your dog? And you say, "Of course I do." Does your dog talk back? Well, not really. Does your dog obey you? And then you probably say, "Well, it depends if I've trained my dog." You can find some dogs that are amazingly well trained, and they will sit, and they will go down, and they will stay in their place until maybe they get antsy, and they think you're not looking, and they'll get up. And then you say, "Sit down, be quiet." And they go to their little bed, or their little kennel. And there they sit. Is that what this story is like? And if it is what this story is like, then the question, who is this man, is a very important question. Now, which world do you believe in? Is nature a person? Is nature a thing? Is it simply math? Which world would you rather inhabit? But now you have to be careful with this question, because if nature is just math and you are a part of nature, then you are just math too. You just don't know your math. Now, why the storm? Why did Jesus not just rebuke the storm, but also the disciples? Was he annoyed that they woke him up out of a comfortable sleep? The storm didn't wake him up. It's a very interesting tidbit in this story. Now, memories of Jonah come to mind, who also slept in the bottom of the ship in the storm, but Jonah was running from God. What kind of man, however, is comfortable in a storm? Perhaps the kind of man who understands the kinds of pets the master keeps, and that it's finally the word of the master that is in charge. That really unnerves us, because it opens all kinds of questions that we might not be able to answer. Were the disciples in any less danger with Jesus awake? Well, that depends on who's more dangerous, Jesus or the storm. The disciples are afraid, but it seems that it's fear itself that brings them their rebuke. Isn't faith, however, for the storm? You don't need faith when the sea is placid and giving you fish. You need faith when the sea is stormy and the winds seem to be against you and you imagine you will be swamped by chaos. It's exactly then that you need faith. So is waking the master an expression of faith or faithlessness? Well, Jesus seemed to say it was faithlessness. Even rebellious Jonah didn't fear the sea or the wind. He tells the sailors, "Throw me in." He feared the master and the maker of both. But of course, the master and the maker of both was not going to let Jonah have his way, because he is the master and the maker and the author. But that should really scare you, and that may even trouble you. But again, which world would you rather have? Because your choices aren't great. Do you want meaning? Or do you want fear? Why do we respect courage? Now, this would be a lovely story if it weren't for the fact that darkness is going to appear. Now, when it was noon, math says noon should be full of sun. When it was noon, darkness came around the whole land until 3 p.m. Around 3 o'clock, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Now, given the boat incident, what are we to think of Jesus? In this moment, does Jesus understand our plea, our pain, our terror? Does he understand in that moment the terror of his father? Now, these are deep and strange things. But Christians believe it's actually in this moment that Jesus was not simply suffering with us, but Jesus was suffering for us. What storm are you in? Almost everybody has a storm. Storms come and go. The seas can be placid, or the storms can be blowing. How are you responding to the storm? Does it look like Jesus is sleeping through it? If he is, that's probably a good sign, if you're in the boat with him. What if you can't seem to wake him up? Might you trust in him still? He who experienced the darkness and ask the question, "Why have you forsaken me?" He who saw that through to Easter. Does the question of the disciples still linger in your mind? Do you think he cares? If he didn't care, why would he have gone into the darkness?